Happy to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're starting our program today by talking with you about strategic investing for retirement. Frank Armstrong of Coconut Grove, Florida, with us by phone today. He is founder of the investment advisor firm Investor Solutions, Inc. He's the author of the book, The Informed Investor. It's published by Amicon. And go online, take a look at his website. It's investorsolutions.com. I have that up on my computer right now, as a matter of fact. I'm really pleased to have him with us today. Certainly, if you have some investment questions, please join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. So contact us, and we'll be glad to get your question to Frank. Frank Armstrong, welcome back. Thanks for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Larry. Thanks.
Appreciate it very much. Well, now we've got our baby boomers hitting retirement age. We've got some volatile financial markets that may increase the risk that this new wave of retirees could outlive their nest eggs. How do you reduce the volatility of your investment portfolio?
Well, the volatility is certainly troubling, but for people who have the appropriate asset allocation and plenty of liquidity in their portfolio, it's more of a nuisance than an economic problem. If you started out and said, okay, I want to have the next 7 to 10 years of my known distributions available in a near cash equivalent, and then the rest, say 50, 60% is in long-term growth assets, then really your portfolio shouldn't have been impacted horribly, and you should be able to sleep well at night knowing that you can make all those payments for the next period of time.
Joel in Burlington, Iowa has a question for you. Joel, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I had a question for what percentage of your overall portfolio should be invested in alternative investments such as rental properties or things of that nature?
Well, we have an allocation to alternative investments that are fully liquid through real estate investment trusts and both foreign and domestic, and a commodities futures position. These are either mutual funds or real estate exchange traded funds. We can buy them or sell them almost instantly. I'm not a big advocate of people. Unless they're experts in the field, buying rental properties and trying to manage those, because as you can see, the real estate markets can be as volatile or worse than the stock market, and you can, in fact, put yourself in a position from which you can't easily extract yourself. But you know, I would say 20% of your equity portfolio, not the total portfolio, but that amount which is invested in volatile long-term assets, could be in the alternative investments.
Okay. That answer your question, Joel?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Over time, do stocks outperform the traditional retiree choice of bonds?
Well, they sure do. I mean, there's well-defined risk premiums in the stock markets, which is the amount of extra return you get over the safe investments, the zero-risk assets. And over the period of, say, 1926, in general terms, Treasury bonds, which are the zero-risk asset, have yielded maybe 3-3.5%. Longer-term Treasuries have yielded 4. Commercial bonds have yielded 5. And then you have this big jump up to the stock market, which has been between 10 and 11. Well, that's an enormous increase in total return over the bond market. So when you figure that inflation is running 3% since that period of time, then the shorter-term zero-risk assets have yielded no real growth over the inflation mark. So what you have to do is to determine how much you can put at risk and ride the ups and downs, but have a floor of very safe assets available to meet your cash distribution needs. And everybody can pick the point, the mix between stocks and bonds for themselves to meet their needs. But you certainly would be poorly advised to to have an all bond portfolio to meet your long-term needs.
Yeah. What are the new these covered call rating funds? They sell options on stocks they hold.
Yeah, well, it's not new. In the 80s, all the mutual fund companies couldn't wait to do that. And what we discovered is that it doesn't take you off the old risk-reward line. It just changes the risk-reward parameters a little. And it eats up your capital because these covered calls occasionally get called when the stock goes up. And you would like to have it. You end up having to have sold it. So you don't get the capital appreciation, you do get a little more income, but there are better ways to get to the same result without doing the covered call strategy. I don't believe past history, the whole past history of all those funds, are they disappeared, and that's got to tell you something.
Yeah. So a better strategy would be?
Well, I think you just have to determine that you're going to put up with the gyrations of the stock market, such as they are, diversify as much as you can around the world, and then determine how much of it you need in fixed income, and do what we call, instead of trying to generate income from these covered calls, do what we call a artificial dividend by paring out portions of your portfolio from both the growth and the income side.
Yeah. Well, in talking, you mentioned with our previous caller something about housing, and it reminded me, I think it was a couple of years ago, that we talked about problems to be faced with variable interest and interest-only mortgages. What are your thoughts today about the home mortgage situation and what Congress...
Well, they haven't changed much. Those are, I think I probably called them toxic products back
then. I think you did.
The so-called ninja loan, which is no income, no job, and no assets, and 100% down, and an adjustable rate mortgage someplace down the road, is a formula for absolute disaster if, in fact, housing prices don't continue to go straight up and your income goes straight up, then, if anything goes wrong, Katie, bar the door.
Yeah.
And in fact, we live in a world where you can predict that things go wrong from time to time.
You sure can.
And that's not new. I mean, Moses has had that problem, too. I mean, things just don't go the way we plan, and they don't happen because we wish them to. We have to be prepared for some downside in any investment portfolio.
Yeah. Kim in Wausau is up next. Kim, hi.
Hi. I'm a widow who has a life insurance policy that I have sitting in a money market account, and I'm really not sure what would be the best plan. I do have other investments just through work. I have deferred compensation program,
mm-hmm.
and I have Edvest for my two children as well that I put money into each year. And the only debt I have is my home mortgage, which I can manage with my current income. So I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions for me to have money set aside for the kids and myself.
I don't know nearly enough to give you individual advice, but let me ask you, when you said you have life insurance money, is that proceeds from your husband's policy?
Yes.
Or you have a life insurance policy on your own life?
I have both.
So you have proceeds from your husband.
Right, that I just haven't.
Mm-hmm. You have to do the same thing that any other investor does, and your situation is probably very similar to a retiree. You need to generate so much income, and you need to plan for the long haul, too. And so you have to sit down and determine what your objectives are, what your financial situation is, do some investment and financial planning, and then design the appropriate asset allocation to meet those needs. I'd love to tell you what the exact formula would be for you, but we'd have to talk about that for quite some time, and I'd need a lot more information. There's answers, and then there's good answers.
Yeah.
Answers are free. Good answers take a little time to think themselves through.
Okay. And my other question was, I had been doing some reading, and I had read that a person could go through blue chip companies themselves. There's particular companies that would offer for individuals to invest with them directly. And I'm wondering
That's true, and you can reinvest the dividends, but you can't possibly, if you're Bill Gates, you can, but the rest of us can't possibly build a diversified portfolio using that limited number of stocks. Mostly those are the bigger companies that have the lower expected returns over the rest of your life, and they're mostly domestic. And I, for my money, for my clients' money, I think you're far better served to buy institutional class index funds and buy the whole world's markets, and reduce your risk, and capture some of the additional growth that's out there.
Okay.
You know, if you think about it, the blue chip stocks are the ones that offer these programs typically. They're the largest, most successful companies in the largest, safest market in the world. Why would you expect that they'd have the best return, since they're probably arguably some of the lowest risk? And you can diversify all that risk away around the world and get a higher return without a lot of trouble and without a lot of cost. And for me, the bookkeeping would be just on if I had a half a dozen or so of these other automatic investment programs, the bookkeeping would be just horrendous trying to keep up with and you can't build a diversified portfolio that way.
No.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Kim.
Thanks
very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Talking today with Frank Armstrong, founder of the investment advisor firm Investor Solutions, Inc., author of the book The Informed Investor, and has a nice website at investorsolutions.com. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in with your questions for Frank Armstrong as we talk managing your money and investing for retirement. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And Frank, let's talk a little bit about the presidential race and how it relates to investing. What would you tell the 2008 presidential candidates to do about the economy?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, they'd probably get quite a
get an earful.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I believe that when we talk about limiting free trade, that's a giant mistake. I think that, you know, we need to make substantial investments in our infrastructure, which could help to stimulate the economy some. Potholes in the roads, bridges falling down, levees falling down, all those things indicate to me that, you know, perhaps some long-term investments should be made. The corporate tax structure is a disgrace. We need to drastically lower corporate taxes and change the treatment of dividends so that dividends become tax deductible to the corporation and fully taxable to the investor rather than this 15% charade we go through to avoid double taxation. The dollar obviously would respond to a comprehensive energy policy, and the last 7 years of tax policy, I think, have been extraordinarily unfair to working Americans in the lower class, economic classes. Those of us who are blessed with a pretty decent income can afford to pay more so that other people can have health care and decent schools and fire and police protection and those things that only governments can provide. You know, it's almost like, where do you start? And there's the whole idea of a gas tax holiday is an abomination. That's just pandering to not very bright voters. I don't like paying $4 a gallon for gas, but if it were up to me, I'd put a $3 tax on top of that at the pump, because we're, as the president observed some time ago and then didn't do anything about, we're addicted to energy consumption, and the only way what we've seen, that I just heard 30 billion miles less driven in the last 6 months as a result of the price of oil. Well, our costs are still far below what the Europeans have been paying traditionally, and what they get over there is a rational transportation policy. And I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. It's like, almost don't get me started. But you did. You did. You made the mistake of getting me started, Larry.
That's all right. It's good to hear what
you have. Give me a chance to vent.
Well, Bob in Darlington has a comment or question, so let's go to Bob.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
And I want to agree with the gentleman on now. I'll be 77 years old, and I'm a retiree. My wife and I, we both worked at the university for many a long year, and we've done quite successful with our investing because we knew that it probably was smart to diversify. And not that we're superstars in that area, but at least we've done reasonable, and we've got annuities, and we've got our IRA and mutual funds and different things. But I really want to agree with you on a more important thing, and it's the rebuilding of our infrastructure in this nation. And to protect my little great-grandchildren, we have great-grandchildren now, and the only way they're going to survive and do well is if we build up a new infrastructure. And by that, I mean, like you said, roads and bridges and all these things that are really needed to repair, and land levies, were needed. And if we don't have that in place in another decade or so, we're going to be in real, real trouble.
Well, I agree. And it's not just that. It's everything from cable fiber optics to better educational facilities. K-1 through 12 in particular needs to be bolstered here. All kinds of infrastructure investments that just cry out to be made. And a transportation policy that makes sense. I mean, it just took me 12 hours to get home from Washington, D.C., a two-hour flight. I had to go from Washington to New York to Miami, and it took 12 hours. There's not one seat. On Wednesday, there was not one seat direct from Washington to Miami for 3 days available. So I had to go to New York. And that's, we don't have a rational transportation policy. We ought to have bullet trains to start in Miami, go to Orlando, Jacksonville, Atlanta, through the Carolinas, the Research Triangle, off to Philadelphia, Newark, New York, Boston, and get those airplanes out of those short-haul, high-density markets. It's crazy. And on and on and on and on. The gentleman who just called in, he's been egging me on and getting me started, too. But really, there's so much we need to do, and we need to be discussing all of these real issues instead of playing games on politics and parsing every second word and trying to find somebody who you can misinterpret for fun and profit.
Well, you're a man that's got the right opinions, I'll tell you that.
Well, you must be a particularly bright guy yourself, sir.
Well, but, the investing that we've done over the years to build up and bolster our retirement hasn't been exactly super, but at least it's reasonable. And I was told many years ago that, Bob, what you really should do, you and Audrey, your wonderful wife, she worked, too, all those years, and what you really should do is learn to diversify. And what you invest in isn't probably as critical as that. What do you think about that statement?
Well, I think diversification is your buddy, as Merton Miller used to say, who won a Nobel Prize in economics. Uh-huh. When you get to the end of the road in diversification, you've gotten large and small and foreign and domestic and value stocks, and then you've done real estate and the commodities futures. At the end of that process, you're still left with market risk, but every other risk you can diversify away, and people who don't diversify are just really building themselves in huge problems that they don't need to have.
Yeah.
So I couldn't agree more. Diversification is the very single thing that you can do for your portfolio that will enhance your future security.
Yeah.
Well, you know what you're talking about, sir.
Thanks, Bob.
Yep.
Thanks, appreciate Bob. The call.
He must be bright. He agrees with us.
Let's go to Doug in Madison next. Doug, hello to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to, first of all, I've been an investment advisor for 20 years prior to my retirement, and I've spent a lifetime of investing. And I want to tell you that your guest today is right on and experienced and giving the best advice of most anybody I've heard on the radio.
Well, that's very, very kind. Very kind. Thank you, sir.
One small item I think you mentioned was you like the index funds, and that's one area that I would have a disagreement with you on. I find that there are a number of really excellent managers that outperform index funds consistently. But other than that, I think you're doing just great.
Well, we
can agree to disagree on that. I think the overwhelming evidence would point the other way. There are always managers who outperform, but it's so tough to identify them in advance that a better policy might be just to accept that markets are reasonably efficient.
Yeah.
You were so kind about your first observations that I'm not going to quibble too much about the other. This has turned into a love-in, Larry.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. You could join in, too. Maybe you disagree with our guest with Frank today.
Would be fun, too.
Yeah. Or maybe you agree, or maybe you just wonder about something relating to investing. Tell you what, there's no question that we can't take a crack at here at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890, and you can email us at talk@wpr.org. This is an investment question in a way, and it relates to Social Security and Medicare.
The Ponzi scheme.
Yeah. What are we? Why can't we fix that? Why can't politicians fix that? Those shortages, if they seem to be driving the country into. Some people say they're driving us into bankruptcy.
Well, it's a lack of political will. It's often referred to as the third rail of politics. And in fact, as the demographics change, the tax receipts from Social Security are no longer going to cover the payments that go out. And when they do, you're going to have to dip into the general treasury. Right now, the government's systematically stealing Social Security payments from workers and putting it to work in other areas. That turns around down the road. I think the Secretary of the Treasury, Paulson, in a report came out and said that to start to fix the problem, we need to cut benefits by 25%, increase taxes by 50%. But it really doesn't fix the problem unless you actually invest the money, because we have a country of 300 million plus older people. And not one penny set aside to meet their retirement in this so-called Social Security Trust Fund. All they have is a stack of IOUs from the governments. And, in fact, it's going to cripple the economy later because payroll taxes are going to have to rise dramatically, as they are in Europe, in order to come close to making the Social Security payments that people have been led to expect. And if you think that's bad, just wait for Medicare. But without the political will, without the average citizen putting the politician's little feet to the fire and saying, look, we really got to start to fix this, then nothing's going to happen. But the average citizen is sitting there saying, lie to me, baby. Tell me how good it is. Tell me we don't have to do anything, and I'm going to get my retirement, and I don't have to worry, and I can go back to sleep or watch the Super Bowl or something.
Yeah.
But, I mean, everybody knows what the problem is, but once you say, well, we got to raise taxes or start to invest it, then everybody else jumps on you in a political arena, I don't know if they're pandering or stupid, or if they're lying or stupid. I don't know. It doesn't matter. The fact is, it's a dysfunctional policy, and it's going to bite our children, who are going to have to pay for it.
No. David in Ashland is up next. David, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Given that the price of gas isn't likely to drop significantly in the near or maybe in the future at all, I'm sort of curious what your guest thinks about the idea of taking a small percentage of your overall investment portfolio and trying to invest it in individual stocks related to energy, such as solar power stocks or stocks in a railroad company. And I'll take my take the answer off the air.
Thanks. All right, thank you for calling.
Well, you and I, sir, are not the only two people who have this intuition. And so in economic theory and probably in practice, the future earnings that these industries might bring us have already been priced into the stocks. And so I will fall back on my default position that says trying to overweight a segment of the economy like green investing or energy investing or some area like that is probably an exercise in futility. The market has already sorted that out, and it's reflected in the price of the stocks. So we don't think you ought to overweight any particular industry segment, and I'm not convinced that I could have an insight that would allow me to beat the rest of the 500 million or so people who are playing the same game I am. And perhaps looking at much better information than I have.
Yeah. Rodney and Hudson, your turn. Hi, Rod.
Hi, gentlemen. My question was, like the last caller, would this be a time that I could jump into oil stocks or the corn commodity market that's, went from $4 to $7 the other day? And one more comment I'll make is I heard one gentleman say the best stock to buy right now is that in the future, all these retirees, one out of 50, Frank, will either have knee or hip or replacement surgery. What do you think?
Well, again, on the healthcare question, we all know we're getting older, and we all know that there's a higher percentage of the GDP is going to have to go to healthcare as a result. And that's already been priced into the healthcare stocks, and I don't think that healthcare has had any substantially different risk reward characteristics than the rest of the broad market. In fact, I would tell you it's probably much higher risk. And the same is true of the other stocks that you mentioned. There's risks associated with all of those, and I'm a risk avoider. I do everything I can to reduce risk in the portfolio and make this as boring as it can possibly be, because when risk manifests itself in a really bad outcome, then you sit and you say to yourself, how could I have ever thought that? And there's so many smart people playing the game that it's hard to get a jump on all of them. By waking up and saying to yourself, gee, corn must go up. We've had all these floods, et cetera. It's gone up, and it's already too late for you to get on it.
Yeah. Yeah, it needed to have been on it a while back, and then you never know.
But it's a random event. You couldn't have predicted the floods and the weather.
No.
And so it's a random event. And unless you have a really, really good crystal ball, you're better served to just invest in the broad market and diversify as widely as you can and let the market sort this stuff out.
Yeah, we can't all be as lucky as a friend of mine who, now this goes back many years ago, who decided to buy some silver's futures, and he bought the day before the Hunt brothers tried to corner the market, the silver's futures market.
Well,
and he sold the day before it crashed. Yeah, and
well, but for every one of those guys, there's 100 guys who's got egg in his face.
Probably thousands, not 100.
The median investor trying to do that has had a very bad experience.
Oh yes,
the man who buys the entire market, we take our lumps from time to time, but overall, it's the path of least resistance to get a good outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. It probably wasn't hundreds. It was probably thousands of people who went the other way.
I was trying to be generous.
Bruce in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah. Mike, do you use ETFs at all, or do you get into that or not?
I sure do. I think they're great. But, you know, they're only great in certain markets that are highly liquid and easily traded, because in some of the more profitable markets, like say, foreign small value stocks, there's not enough liquidity there, and the trading costs are too high for the people who make
the ETFs.
What's that?
Do you look at the volume of the trades or what?
Wait, but
no, the liquidity costs, for instance, put yourself in the position of the people who manufacture ETFs.
What are ETFs, by the way? Somebody's
exchange-traded funds are like an index fund, only they're traded minute by minute,
okay.
Like the old closed-end funds.
Okay.
But the problem that you have as the manufacturer is you have to stand ready to create and redeem those shares instantly when an institutional investor comes to you. And if it costs you 10% round trip to get into a small stock, that's a losing, you know, you just can't manufacture and do that with these tremendous trading costs in these illiquid markets. So in the broad markets, for instance, the foreign large stocks represented by Europe, Australia, Far East, EFA, or the S&P 500, or even the broad general market in the United States, they're the best, most liquid, lowest cost way to get in exposure to those markets. But other markets have not yet evolved to the position, or the product isn't available where we can economically get access to some markets that we think potentially are very high profit.
Interesting. Bruce, thanks.
Yep, okay, thanks.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Bill in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Question is, are long short funds worth getting into for us little guys that can't get into hedge funds in a market, especially like this, where there's a lot of downside risk?
Yeah, first tell us, what are long short funds, Frank?
Well, I can tell you. It's where if he's off the air, mm-hmm. it's where a fund manager is delusional enough to think that he can not only pick stocks that are going to outperform, but he can pick stocks that are going to underperform and sell them to get the money to get to on the other side.
Oh.
And no, I don't think that the record would show that they've been able to generate any excess returns using that strategy. As far as being too small to invest in hedge funds, I think hedge funds are truly, truly a poor way to invest, because if you take a look at the risk that they run by leveraging up their investments and then the extraordinary high fees that are charged. The hedge fund managers are many of them billionaires. The hedge fund investors are across the board, if you even them out, getting substandard returns and enduring lots of risk that they don't need.
Greg in Eagle River, we'll go to you now. Hi, Greg.
Hello. I have a question about annuities. My portfolio manager for my 403B has tried to push annuities with the guaranteed return, and I look at those the prices, the fees that are charged, and I have great difficulty believing that I will benefit significantly from those. I think he will benefit more with the fees. So that's my question, I guess. What do you think?
Well, that's not a question, but I couldn't agree with you more. You know, the fees are enough to gag a maggot, and the additional benefit is hard to discern. You know, it's driven by commissions more than anything else. If you analyze the structure of an annuity versus, say, the same fund purchased no load on the outside, if the annuity features were free, you wouldn't want to have them. And there's no excuse, none at all, for having an annuity inside a 403B, because there's no additional benefit to the investor to pay those additional costs. I'm surprised that those people dare to walk into classrooms or on military posts, or they should be tarred and feathered, in my humble opinion.
through a hospital, but it's just been very annoying to me, and he's aware that I've been very annoyed because I've done a lot of research on this.
You need to find another advisor, and you need to complain to the plan sponsor and try and get somebody like Vanguard in there to give you their institutional class, no-load index funds, because that's the best way to get access to the world's markets without paying obscene fees.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Greg. Dan in White Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. Speaking of fees, what is an ordinary fee in an no-load index mutual fund? What sort of range do they fall in?
All right, well, I think you're looking at fees of about, in retail funds, ordinary no-load funds, you're looking at fees that can run from about 0.15% or 15 basis points in the industry lingo to about 1%, depending on the market. It's much more expensive to do business in emerging markets, for instance, than it is here in the S&P 500. So those funds' fees will be a little higher. Now, another consideration, though, is where you can substitute equally for an exchange-traded fund like the S&P or the broad market indexes, you can get your fees, your costs down lower there. But that would be the range the exchange-traded funds might be as low as 8 basis points or 0.08%. But there's an acquisition cost you have to trade off. You wouldn't want to be buying 2 shares a day for the rest of your life.
Thank you.
But so, you know, the range is much lower. Now, it's important to compare that to actively managed no-load funds, where the average cost is probably 1.8%, and the average benefits is probably minus 1%. So, you know, we think that the trade-off is really favors the idea of the index fund versus the active fund, because the expenses are lower, the risk is lower, and the performance as a result is going to be better.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan, for calling. And, Frank, thank you so much. Again, it's always a pleasure. And just to go back to your website, because I know you've got a newsletter people can sign up for free.
Sure. It comes out every 2 weeks. We're about to publish one today, and we probably have 500 articles on the website that are timeless. I don't much care what the market does yesterday or today. You know that, Larry.
Yeah.
So you can peruse the website. There's a great library of articles that me and my staff have written, and we're more than happy for people to sign up for that. It's investorsolutions.com, and right there you can sign up for the website.
Frank,
I want to thank you. It's been a great opportunity to get on my soapbox today, and I've you got me going. You got my blood pumping.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Frank. Thanks so much. We'll look forward to your next visit.
My pleasure, guys.
Thanks a lot. Frank Armstrong of Coconut Grove, Florida, founder of the investment advisor firm Investor Solutions, Inc., and author of the book The Informed Investor. It's published by Amicon. And again, his website is investorsolutions.com. Great. Take a look at it. I've got it up right now, and there's that free newsletter you can get yourself signed up for. Well, we've took a look at your financial health. Let's take a look at your physical health coming up next year with Dustin Maher on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.